and welcome to Worlds Apart. The American claim to global dominance, at least on the rhetorical surface, was meant to safeguard humanity from falling into the abyss of chaos and abject cruelty. That's what liberal values, rights, and rules so obstinately foisted onto other nations were supposed to achieve only a few years ago. But nowadays, this discourse seems to be falling out of fashion. What's coming to replace it as the justification for ruling the world? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Lawrence Wilkerson, retired U.S. Army colonel and former chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Mr. Wilkerson, it's great to see you. Thank you very much for your time.
Good to be with you.
Given your background, we invited you to discuss some security issues, but I want to start with a question on personal security, because over the last couple of weeks, several colleagues of mine were harshly interrogated by the FBI, with their houses searched, with their family members scared. And that was simply for voicing opinions deemed to be sympathetic to the Russian stance, or for cooperating with RT. Aren't you concerned about possible repercussions for giving such an interview?
I'm not concerned about any repercussions for me personally, but I am very much concerned about the state of our democracy here in the United States. These actions, in my view, and I think in many others' views, are unconstitutional. For example, my appearing with you is nothing but my appearing on a television show or a media show to express my views about the world situation, including the situation with the United States. I'm not paid for it. I'm not cajoled into doing it. I'm not pressured into doing it. So this is a violation of my constitutional rights should anything occur to me because of this. And I think that's a horrible thing to be happening in a country that proclaims that it is a bastion of freedom.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that bastion of freedom, in one recent example, a colleague of mine, a 30-something-year-old woman, who worked for RT America as a guest producer, so she may have arranged some of the interviews of you with us before. She was interrogated. She was woken up at 5 o'clock in the morning by 20-something agents. She was questioned for 5 hours straight, pretty much undressed because she didn't have time to get dressed. Her house was turned upside down. And what I thought was particularly interesting is that the two main agents interrogating her were of Polish and Ukrainian origin. And I wonder if that is a standard practice for the FBI these days to engage with foreign nationals like that, or is it a specific treat for Russian nationals?
I think the latter, but it is increasingly becoming the modus operandi for a lot of the security element and intelligence elements in my country. And as I said, I'm very alarmed by that. Everything from the prosecution to the hilt of Julian Assange, who was doing his job as a journalist, nothing more, nothing less, to the a stopping of Scott Ritter and confiscation of his passport and papers at, I think, an airport in New York. This is disgusting. This is a violation of everything the United States stands for, supposedly, and everything the Constitution supports and demands. And I think it's unconscionable. Now, I've had the FBI visit me. On two occasions, I've had them visit me. I feel like that those visits were short and sweet, as it were, because at the time, Colin Powell was still alive and they feared him. Now that he's passed away, I'm not so sure that they have that sort of fear hanging over their head now. And I, you know, I expect to be visited again, probably, but I will continue to claim that it's a violation of my rights under the Constitution of the United States.
Well, you know, there was a time when all of us Russian journalists were treated more or less politely and respectfully in the United States. I mean, RT America operated in the United States for a long time. I remember our editor-in-chief, Margarita Simonyan, was invited to be at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and American officials on a number of occasions communicated to my channel that we are allowed to operate. We are not falling under this Foreign Agents Act. And yet some of my colleagues, including this young lady that I mentioned, she was accused of serving as a foreign agent in the United States, even though her duties were very technical, very logistical. And what I want to ask you about is, what do you make of this sudden change in how American officials relate to RT and how they treat this Espionage Act? Because all of a sudden, we became spies and foreign agents, while just a couple of years ago, we were more or less legit.
Absolutely. In fact, when I left the State Department in January of 2005 and subsequent years to that, I did interviews with RT all the time, downtown in Washington, D.C., at your main studios. And there was no qualms about it. There was no strictures about it. They were another outlet. And that's simply the way we dealt with it. I think the United States has become, as I pointed out with Julian Assange in spades, the United States have become a very draconian society now. And it's particularly draconian with regard to Moscow and with regard to Beijing, and to a large extent with regard to Tehran also. And that's a shame, because those are the countries, if we call them enemies, those are the countries whom we should be talking to most frequently and most pointedly. And we're not. I remember when Colin Powell would tell me things after Sergei Lavrov and he had met, or for that matter, the Chinese foreign minister he had met, or I had met with Wang Yi, now a fairly powerful person in China. And we all had respect for all of these people. He particularly had respect for Sergei Lavrov. He once called him one of the finest diplomats in the world. Look at where we are now. We won't even talk to Sergei Lavrov. I understand there's an executive order to the Secretary of State and others in the Biden administration that they dare not talk to Sergei. This is preposterous. This is not the way the world should be conducted. It's not the way diplomacy of the United States should be conducted.
You mentioned that you've been giving many interviews, and I think you've been pretty consistent in your criticism of American policy, especially as it relates to fighting and sponsoring wars and foreign engagements. And I think it's fair to say at this point of time that moral or even logical arguments don't impress American officials that much anymore. Is it still worthwhile for you to try to articulate your position, given the risks involved and your society becoming, as you said, more draconian day by day?
I don't feel like I have any other choice. I'm 80 years old, so there's a little risk to me. I'm not going to live that much longer. But I feel like I owe it to the idea that I have of my country. After all, I served my country in war, in combat, in the service for 31 years. And then I served it another 5 years in the diplomatic service. I served one of the best individuals I've ever known in my life, Colin Powell. I used to call him a Black Eisenhower. And I fully believe that he was. So I feel like I have an obligation to my country, and I certainly don't feel like I have much of an obligation to the current set of leadership that the United States is featuring in either party, really. Donald Trump on the one side, prospective new president, or Kamala Harris or Joe Biden on the other side. They're all insane, as far as I'm concerned. They simply have no grasp of strategy, no grasp of geopolitical and geostrategic situations in the world. And I think they're doing great damage to the United States, both domestically and externally.
Now, let's talk about some of these wars. And I want to start with the one that is closest to me. That is the one in Ukraine. There is now a vibrant discussion in Washington and some other Western capitals as to whether or not the Americans should authorize the use of long-range striking weapons onto the Russian territory. Do you think it will come to pass?
I hope not. I certainly hope not, because I'll quote your own leader, Vladimir Putin, quote, aggression against Russia by any non-nuclear state, but with the participation or support of a nuclear state, read the United States and other NATO countries, will be considered a joint attack on the Russian Federation. Now, I've been studying Russian doctrine since the Swedes and the Finns and the Norwegians were battlefield observers, as it were, back in 2011, 2012, and 2013, when Russia was conducting core size exercises in its own territory, peaceful exercises. And I know how that doctrine evolved. And I know that Putin is now telling us that that doctrine is in force, full scale, that if NATO is helping Ukraine to attack Russia in these flagrant ways, that he will respond. And I assume that he means the first phase of his responses will be avant-garde missiles that are so fast, nothing can shoot them down. And when they hit, they have the impact of a small-yield nuclear weapon. Two or three of them on Kyiv, for example, would probably obliterate 50% of Kyiv. So I don't think he's bluffing. I think my leaders think he's bluffing. I don't think he's bluffing. I think he's been very clear. He's been very precise, and he's been very prudent in his remarks up to this point.
You mentioned that he's being very prudent, and I think, believe it or not, but he's guided by his own moral code. I think there is a very distinct set of values and red lines that the Russian military has set for themselves. And yet there is a major tactical and strategic problem that remains, not only for Russia, I think many other countries are watching it as well, as to how you deal with proxy dynamics, because at this point of time, you still have Kyiv and the West sort of playing this, well, not even the game of chicken. I mean, the upping up of the ante is coming at the expense of Ukraine, but it is sponsored by the West. And at the same time, the West can pretend that it has nothing to do with it. And it's hard to understand, I guess, for Moscow, how to drive the message home to Western capitals that their actions also will have consequences. I want to ask you, as a military man, apart from these amendments that you mentioned to the nuclear doctrine, do you think Moscow can do anything else to persuade decision makers in Washington, in London, and perhaps other capitals that it means business, that it's serious?
I do not have any suggestions other than continue on the path that they currently are on. You have to go back, and I know you know this story, but you have to go back and look at how we've perverted the whole story of Ukraine and how Ukraine, as it were, was created by NATO and the United States, London and Washington in particular, and how they are using that to bleed Russia. And there's no other way a geostrategic mind like my own can conclude. If you're thinking sanely and soberly, we did this. We started this. We forced Vladimir Putin into the action he took because he feared our putting anti-ballistic missile carriers in the easternmost parts of Ukraine, which could reach Moscow, violation of the INF Treaty, and could easily be converted to nuclear weapons launching platforms. So I understand what he did. I don't necessarily condone the methodology he used to do it, but I understand why he did it. On the other side of the ocean, as it were, in Washington and in London in particular, there's no understanding of that, or there's a bastardization of it, because let's face it, we're making fortunes off the weapon sales and other aspects of this war. And we're not risking our soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, or anything. It's a proxy war.
Absolutely. But Mr. Wilkerson, you said that you are not losing your soldiers on the battleground, and it's true, but supposedly the United States stands for human rights, and it has some, I want to believe at least, that it has some basic empathy. And when we look at the Ukrainian military situation, I'm sure you know that their biggest shortage now is not weapons, but actually the men who can operate them efficiently, because the Ukrainian army is now being replenished by the people who happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time to be picked up by the recruiters and sent to the front lines without much training or even without reliable weapons. I want to ask you, as a person who gave 30 years of your life to the military service for your country, how do you feel about such a use of, let's call them, human resources?
I think it's horrible. Just as I think the situation in Gaza is horrible. And I think the United States is to blame for that situation. People keep telling me, well, it's Netanyahu, it's Israel. Well, it is on the ground, but the ultimate blame is in Washington. The ultimate blame for, I think, 200,000 upwards of dead Palestinians, women, children predominantly, is the United States of America. Same with Ukraine. The United States of America is keeping this conflict going and killing Ukrainian boys and girls, killing Russians too, and doing it in the process of losing. Ukraine has lost this war. And only thing I can conclude, other than that they're stupid, insane, unwise, you pick the adjective in Washington, and that could be true. The only thing I can conclude is that they are pursuing it for their own reasons, and those reasons are making money and bleeding Russia. Mm-hmm. And this is not the way to risk the world with regard to a potential nuclear holocaust. And that's what we're doing now. And not just in Ukraine. We're also risking that in the Levant, in the Middle East.
Okay, well, Mr. Wilkerson, we have to take a short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
My fellow Americans, today our armed forces joined our NATO allies in airstrikes against Serbian forces.
To je bilo kad su gađali, bilo je sprotiva su tamo bili topovi, tenkovi, to su gađano sve.
This is ammunition which is reinforced with depleted uranium that has a special capacity to penetrate. From a nuclear safety point of view, there is no radiological or even not even significant consequences.
This cemetery seems endless. A real city of the dead where it's very easy to get lost. Similar graveyards now exist in Iraq and Afghanistan. They may soon appear in Ukraine, where thousands of square kilometers have already been contaminated with deadly dust for the next 4.5 billion years.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Lawrence Wilkerson, retired U.S. Army colonel and former chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Mr. Wilkerson, before the break, we mentioned Russia's military doctrine. So let me ask you about America's. Washington still openly aims for the so-called full spectrum dominance in any part of the world. And that is what your 700 plus military bases, some of them equipped with tactical nuclear weapons, are there for. But is it enough? Is it enough in today's reality? Do you think America can realistically call shots in every single part of the world relying on military power alone?
I think that's the worst possible thing we could do. And you're right, that is principally what we're doing. Remember, I was there with Mikhail Gorbachev and Edward Shevardnadze and Helmut Kohl and Francois Mitterrand and H.W. Bush and Jim Baker and others when we began the process of destroying these horrible lethal weapons. We went on both sides, Russia to roughly about 30,000 warheads, U.S. roughly about 28, 29,000 warheads. We went down to somewhere around 5,000, and we had every intent of going down to roughly 2,000, maybe 1,200 to 2,000 was the range on both sides. We were making the world much, much safer. Now look what we've done. The United States basically unilaterally has abrogated every single treaty regime for nuclear weapons, starting with the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which my administration did in 2002. A preposterous move. Powell rushed off to Moscow to negotiate the Moscow Treaty. Nobody even knows what the Moscow Treaty is today because we've destroyed everything with regard to nuclear weapons control. Even START now is in grave danger of falling. Uh-huh. And we're building out, and the Chinese are building out. And Iran is very close to a nuclear weapon, making it 10 nuclear weapons owning states. We're in a very dangerous world. We're in a more dangerous world today than we were in October of 1962 with regard to Cuba and the missile crisis there. And more significantly, in my view, with regard to Berlin and the crisis in 61 and 62 over Berlin and the GDR, we are closer to nuclear war today than we were then.
I think there is a real erosion of not just international law, but some basic human principles. And it is being committed by America's own allies, Ukraine, with its attacks, repeated attacks on various nuclear facilities. And in Lebanon, we just witnessed this very indiscriminate pager explosion attack, which I've heard some experts compare to poison.
Yeah,
absolutely. But it's not just a terrorist act. Like, it's like well poisoning, because you absolutely don't care about any collateral damage, about anyone who happened to be in the vicinity of the explosion. And I think humanity or nation states abolished this kind of operation a couple of decades ago. I mean, there was a tacit agreement that, you know, we may go to war with one another, but there are still certain rules that we must obey by. What do you make of it? Do you think Washington still has control even over its own allies to sort of encourage them to deal in a civilized manner? Because this is plain barbarity. Even, you know, terrorist groups are not acting like that.
I said yesterday on another television show here in the United States that I think the empire, the American empire, is in its last stage. Usually when empires are in their final stages, and you can look at any of the thousands of empires that have been in existence over the last, 5,000 years of human history, and you'll find this, at the end of their reigns, as it were, they usually do some pretty disastrous things for the rest of the people in the world around them, whether they're Rome, Eastern or Western, or the Mogul or the Mongol or the Ottoman or the British or whatever. I think that's what we're doing now. We are essentially unraveling all of the fabric of international humanitarian law, international criminal law, the ICC, the ICJ, the Court of World Arbitration, all the things that we work for since World War II and in the wake of World War II, all the things we've worked for, including the UN, we are destroying.
And I think one of the reasons why your adversaries, nuclear-armed adversaries like Russia and China, try to be measured and not to take all the baits that the United States is throwing their way is in order to preserve the remnants of that system, because it is true, like, whatever we have at this moment, it may be not satisfactory, but it's much better than a total chaos in which nation states use terrorist attacks to, you know, kill people in a neighboring country, even though they don't even need that much for logistical reasons. Or nation states pick up nuclear stations as their legitimate targets, and no one in the Western world tells them that this is not okay, because it can, you know, at the end of the day, we all may be a collateral damage of such an act.
We used to say in the military, and we said it with some, you might say some humor at times, but we also said it with some degree of seriousness, that we had become the world's policeman post-1945. And there was some truth to that. But it was a policeman that, as you indicated, was somewhat benign. It wasn't.
Well,
so
he was at least serving to protect something rather than destroy it, because, I mean, it's a policeman turned into the worst criminal ever.
And I, as I said, all you have to do is watch the deliberations at the UN Security Council now, whether it's the president of Jordan or it's the president of South Africa or some other representative there. All you have to do is watch them, and you see the entire fabric of what we put together post-World War II being destroyed before our eyes.
Now, going back to the war in Ukraine, as I mentioned, Russia, and I think President Putin has indicated that on a number of occasions, wants to conclude some sort of a peace with its neighbor. Sure, you know, Russia wants its security to be provided for, but I'm sure it's ready for some compromises, because it's in our security interest to live peacefully with the Ukrainians. And as you wrote in your articles, there are no signs that the Biden administration is ready for that. It got me thinking whether America ever ended any of their foreign engagement or any of their wars in a responsible way, with a clear intention and genuine effort for peace. Can you think of such an example?
Well, I think the last time that it actually happened in a formidable way was 1945, when we essentially allowed Germany to come back and be a very prosperous and successful state and then eventually unified. And we allowed Japan to do the same thing. That's the last time. And I would say also that's the last time that we acted as a responsible power in a significant way. We produced the Geneva Conventions out of that, out of Nuremberg and other places like it. The UN fabric that we have today was produced out of that holy, that tremendous war that killed hundreds of millions of people. Since then, I think we've lost it. And we started in the 80s. We picked up speed, if you will, in the 90s. And then when 9/11 happened, when the terrorist attacks happened in 2001, we went off the rails. We went off the rails, and we've been off the rails ever since. And we have a certain breed of cat called neoconservatives who are philosophically and many times experientially and actually practically running our government these days, regardless of the political stripes of the party in power. And that's a shame, but again, these are the sorts of things that happen in empires that are falling apart. We are the first empire in human history to have the technical means to destroy ourselves, and the rest of the world's with us. That's the salient and critical difference between past empires and ours. So our going out in a blaze of fire might take the world with us.
Well, let's hope that this will not happen. And moreover, I think in your articles, you provided some of the ideas of how America's huge military potential could be put to humanity-sustaining use. For example, you articulated that American military and perhaps other countries' militaries could be used for offering help in disaster release. And this is particularly pertinent right now because both the number and the scale of natural disasters is on the increase. Can you talk more about that so that we end at least on an inspirational note?
Look at what's happening in Florida right now and going to continue to happen and increase its frequency in this country and in the global South in particular and across the globe. We've done simulations in the Climate Security Working Group to which I belong, where we show by mid-century there'll be probably 500 million refugees in the world, and many of them will be met by guns on peer power states' borders, powers like Japan, the United States, China, Russia. We'll be manning our borders with militaries with guns to keep these people out. And these people will be coming only because they're starving, because they have no shelter, because they have no food, they have no prospects. That's what the climate is going to do to us. And look at what we're doing. We're even exacerbating that problem with wars, petty little wars. We should stop immediately. We should collaborate. We should cooperate. And we should do it with a sense of purpose, because if we don't, the climate is going to end it for us all.
I think there is also a positive sign in that many other countries, regardless of their political system, are actually helping each other whenever they have a major natural disaster. And I know that your version of global governance includes some sort of a condominium in which the United States, Russia, China, Brazil, South Africa may, and many other countries may play a role, may provide leadership, may provide resources, technologies, what have you. Now, United Nations...
I think we owe that. We owe that particularly to the Global South and others in the world because, let's face it, we're the biggest polluters. And they weren't the biggest polluters. We did it to them. Now we owe them some recompense for what we did to them.
Well, I agree with you that we need to do that not only for them, but also for us as well. But this idea was ultimately at the core of the United Nations, which next year is going to celebrate its 80th anniversary. And I'm sure you would agree with me that the way it goes about global governance is perhaps not very effective. Do you think you will see this global condominium working, genuinely working for the common good in your lifetime?
I'll tell you what one United States senator said to me when I was briefing him on what would happen if a Category 5 hurricane came up the Hudson River and New York was under 15 feet of water for 6 weeks. He said, "We won't do anything until that water is there." I'm afraid he's right. We won't do anything until we're all drowning.
Okay, you may not do anything, but we, meaning the rest of the world, I hope we will stand up to our human responsibility and take, you know, what we can do with this planet and try to make it a better place. If not Americans, that, then perhaps the rest of the world. In any case, we have to leave it there. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for that.
Take care.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.